And also he was the lighting director at all the concerts here at Stony Brook in the late 60s, early 70s. And I just thought, wow, this is really, really interesting. And I spent a lot of time surfing on it. And then I noticed that, well, he lives on Long Island. So I emailed him, and one thing led to another, and then here we are. But what was also very interesting was is that we seemed to know a lot of the same people. And not only that, but Moisey helped build WUSB.
Oh, it's great being in this place. It hasn't changed in, what, 35 years?
Yeah, and nothing's
except
changed.
Except for the wear and tear. It's a wreck.
And nothing's changed. That's the amazing thing. And, well, just very happy to have you here.
Well, I you know, Stony Brook is, it's rock and roll heaven for people of my generation. I was lighting director here from 1967 through 1971. I did all the shows. And this was, the New York Times called this the essential gateway to the East Coast for all the top bands, and that's exactly what it was. You know, we did, it says right on your website that the Grateful Dead's first paying gig on the East Coast was here at Stony Brook. We hired the Allman Brothers, the SAB then was really active. They found the Allman Brothers when they were a $300 bar band. We got them in our gym for a full concert for $300. We got Traffic weeks before Bill Graham did them at the Fillmore. The first American audience to hear John Barleycorn Must Die was right here at Stony Brook. You know, it was just a wonderful time. And the shows were profitable because we were getting all the greatest acts, and they all felt comfortable here. They put on great shows. In 1969, we were so profitable that they had $15,000 left over, and they had to get rid of it because the SAB is nonprofit. So they hired the Jefferson Airplane to do a free outdoor show here. And I got to tell you, it was inspiring to see 15,000 people get off the railroad train at Stony Brook Railroad Station and fill the field. And we had a great show there. I got some good stories about that if we have time about it.
Yeah, well, I find that interesting because it surprised me that there were concerts here in the summer because the students weren't here. And as you said, well, you made money. You had money to spend and money to make. And you had the train station right here.
And we could put on a lot of good shows all year long as a result. We did a bigger schedule here in Stony Brook while I was doing lights here. We did a bigger schedule than I did professionally when I left here for the real world all over New York. I mean, it was a serious concert schedule. You have about 150 shows for those 4 years on your website. And
that's WUSB.org.
That's right.
Yeah, and somewhere there's a link to it.
Yeah, it's an undated list, but it has everybody. But what you don't see there is how many shows. You see a name, but you don't realize that the Allman Brothers they considered themselves our house band, and in 2 years they did five shows here with Dwayne and Dickey, and you know they did I think one of their last major concerts here about 5 weeks before Dwayne got killed in the motorcycle accident, and a couple of great recordings came out of that. The 1971 concert they recorded themselves. It's available on their hitting the music, hitting the note website.
Right, so that's sold by the through the Allman Brothers themselves. They sell a couple.
Yeah. But then we were Seth Dworkin, who used to work here at the radio station. He's no longer with us now, but he was a really, really terrific sound man. And one of the nice things about doing shows here, we kind of did what paralleled what the Fillmore was doing. We didn't have quite what they had, but we did everything. And they had like John Chester had a sound studio, a full recording studio under the stage there. We didn't have that. We had one borrowed Ampex 301 from WUSB, and we just let the tapes roll. So there's a lot of breaks in the music, but we everything was recorded. And Seth made some really dynamite stuff.
Did you have a sense back then of, you know, the history that was being made? Or was this sort of like, oh, this is what we're doing, and then later you look back on it?
Are you talking about the rest of the world?
No,
or are you talking
just
about me?
At the time. Yeah, I mean, you and Seth and everybody involved back at the time. Did you have a feeling for what you were doing that this was so incredible, or was it just, just business as usual?
You couldn't believe the range between naivety and people who were way ahead. The student activities board I was part of that, and only in a creative sense. I was a lighting director, and they liked what I did, and they really facilitated things for me. But the student activities, what those guys knew what they were, they knew what was going on. They went out there and found it before anybody else did and brought it in. I was working the shows, and the variety that was happening at Stony Brook in those days was unbelievable. You could walk into a lounge, and there's Richie Havens playing. We're paying $40 for the night. He's playing in a lounge for free. Anybody can walk in. Allen Ginsberg can fill up a cafeteria with his hand symbols and his poetry. Then you're doing a free show because we have too much money that we made. We have to do the airplane out there. And I think you mentioned earlier Pink Floyd was free to students and 50 cents for outsiders. That was another big show we had to give away because they were making too much money. Were we aware? Oh, my God, were we happy to be here at the music? We knew we were in heaven. Nothing was ever as good as that again. I spent 18 years in the business after that. I'll tell you my favorite story. It's the one show I didn't do. Janis Joplin, there was a little internal politics because I did all the shows for 4 years, and there were some other people that wanted to do the lighting. And I wasn't working that night, and my life revolved around it. So I showed up at crew call time at 10 o'clock in the morning, and the crew call is at 10. You have to build everything, and the bands usually come in 4 or 5. They do a sound check, and then they do their show later on. And there's a hospitality room. Everybody comes in. You plop your knapsack down in the corner. You stake out your territory, so to speak. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. Plop myself down wondering what to do. I'm not on the payroll today. I don't know what's going on. This girl comes over. She plops her knapsack down next to me, pulls out a bottle of Southern Comfort, takes a swig, hands it to me, pass it around the room. Well, I was an engineering student with a crew cut, and I took a swig of that. Boy, that burned my guts out. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I didn't even realize it was Janis Joplin, until I saw her on stage later that night. So there's a difference between, who was paying attention and not. I did the lights. I was behind the scenes. Nobody knows who the lighting director is. We made the photons happen, but the bands, it was, I consider myself to be greatly blessed to have been here those 4 years. It was the best time in the rock and roll industry. And then Stony Brook, I mean, all that other stuff. I mean, jazz, Thelonious Monk here, just, parading back and forth on the stage. Miles Davis, Larry Coryell. We did all these ethnic acts. I mean, you got to see Ola Tunji with a dance company with 25 people doing kind of the Rites of Spring, and they're all jumping on each other's backs, and they got this really large, well, it's a good thing we did these in the gym, let's put it that way. But we had it's just a great time. Did some damage too. You want to hear a Grateful Dead story?
Oh yeah, why not?
Is there anybody around here like the Grateful Dead? I'm a deadhead. I can't.
Well, I've been known to
play a little dead around.
Yeah.
Well, we did the Dead here a lot. They, like the Allman Brothers, considered themselves house band. They always used our sound and lights. Their crews took the night off, and we had a lot of license with these guys. And there's really two things. The first time I saw them here, which was, 1968, I think, was the first paying gig. And you have to picture Pigpen, if you remember Pigpen. Good morning, little school girl. What's that other tune? Turn on your love light. That pretty raunchy stuff. Like, he walks out on stage, and he's wearing a silk turban, a silk blouse, and a full-blown pantaloons. Forget the Pirates of Penzance. This man was the real thing. Red, white, and blue. If you haven't seen that, you haven't lived yet.
Too bad there's no photographs floating around of that.
There could be. There were a couple of good photographers from the Statesman back then that were taking pictures. And I got a few pictures that I have from, but not that one, unfortunately. And then I did the worst thing I ever did in my life to anybody in a band here. I mean, we were so close to the Grateful Dead. And I want to let you know, I survived this. I mean, when I tell you what I did, you're just not going to believe it. But I toured with Jerry Garcia. I toured with Old in the Way. I toured with Burl Saunders. I mean, we were really close to these people for a lot of years. I was an engineering student, and I didn't do psychedelics, but I was really involved in this psychedelic scene. So I got this bright idea that a really bright flash at the right time might, change some people's attitude. And I got a box of what they call press 40 flash bulbs. It's a 100 watt light bulb filled with magnesium, and one of these light up a battleship. You know, so you can front page the New York Times in the middle of the night. I have 20 of them in a box with a reflective plate on it, and I made a deal with Jerry, you know, when we would fire this thing in the show. But in those, that show, this is the 1970 shows. They did, we used to do double shows, early and late shows, Friday and Saturday.
So these are the Halloween 1970.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. And new writers opened up, and Jerry would sit in on pedal steel with the new writers when they were doing that. And now we made this special effect. But what happened is nothing ever works the way it's planned. You know how that is. And they left the pedal steel on the stage just behind where the special effect was for later on in the show. And what they decided was that Jerry was going to do a little pedal steel during the set, during the dead set. And there he is playing a solo on the pedal steel during the Grateful Dead set. And a static charge, who knows? All 20 of these bulbs went off at one time, 6 feet in front of his eyes. It was like somebody hit him in the head with a baseball bat, whiplash. He flipped back. I can't believe he didn't break his neck. Didn't miss a beat. His solo just went on like nothing was happening. Took him 3, 4, 5 minutes before his eyesight came back, and his eyes started looking through the audience for the lighting director. And he found me hiding behind my dimmer boards, and he just mouthed two words that everybody in the audience understood. And that's the worst thing I ever did to anybody. But there's a good ending to that story. We proved a special effect, and we sold it to a band who was more appropriate for Edgar Winter's White Trash. We had 60 bulbs for them, and I made a fortune on the bulbs over the years. But wow. We had a lot of fun. I mean, we had a lot of fun. Did a little damage, too, but...
But he forgave you for that, huh?
Actually, I never had the guts to talk to him after that, which is probably why I spent a lot of time with them. Actually, you know, it's really interesting. I made a decision early on not to talk to the bands, because you do better lights if you don't talk to them, and the band plays better music if they don't talk to, you know, things become more spontaneous, and two people come immediately to mind. The most sensitive musicians that I work with over the years, Laura Nyro, who was so fragile, she was like a robin's egg, and I just literally couldn't talk to her about what I would do for the lighting for her show. I mean, I was afraid she'd crack in front of me. And the other one is Van Morrison, who is probably one of my all-time favorite musicians.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, nonstop. I mean, he's gone through so many changes, and he's just been there. But he did something. Well, we had a very professional lighting setup here, and we had foul spots and carbon arcs, and we played the games in the audience, and we were always aware of what was happening before a show. And when Van Morrison first played here, I noticed for the first time that the star of the show was actually out there mingling with the audience for the opening act. He actually sat in a vacant seat. And then when somebody needed the seat, he got up and he stood and said, he watched the opening act. He was vibing out the audience. He was listening to the room. And then he played his show. And you know, Van Morrison never did a bad show in his life. And in all 18 years I was in the business, every show I did with Van Morrison, we always found him in the audience during the open act. And even if there wasn't an opening act, he would mingle with the crowd before a show. And those are the two most sensitive musicians of them all. I really love them. You know, I just realized it's this is kind of a historic day. In a negative way. This is 1996 on this day. Timothy Leary died.
And no kidding.
It's on your website. It's right there.
On our website.
And I noticed that just before coming in here. And the Moody Blues were playing here. And one of the things about Stony Brook, because it was the cultural, countercultural center of the East Coast, was that the Moody Blues came here. And, well, of course Timothy Leary would show up and walk around stage and in a leather outfit with thrills while they're singing The Legend of a Mind. You know, Timothy Leary's dead. I mean, only at Stony Brook, really, in those days. Only at Stony Brook.
Yeah, actually, it is on the website, wusb.org. Or wusb.fm is also our website.
Yeah, we had there was a lot of firsts that happened here. I think one of the most enjoyable ones was Melanie. I mean, she did her first major performance here. She was, you know, I keep thinking in my mind she was 13, but I'm going to have to guess she was really 15, and she was so afraid. And she just stood on the stage in front of the microphone with stage fright.
No kidding.
Yeah. Well, she's a kid, and she asked the audience for their permission to sit down on the edge of the stage. It was like a 3-foot riser in those days. And so she sat on the front of the stage, and thank God we had follow spotlights, and we were able to put some light on her. And that little girl turned a room, a big room filled with 3,000 people, into this tiny, intimate little nightclub by just knowing what to do. Gosh, I felt so naive. Here I am, a college student here doing all this good stuff, and this young girl just managed the whole show. She was terrific.
Before we went on, somebody mentioned Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix played here. That was absolutely the loudest show that I ever did. One of the problems you have doing live shows is everybody has to talk to each other. On the crew, the follow spots, the lighting director, the stage manager, and Jimmy's guitar, it didn't have a setting of 10; it had a setting of 100, and he was really, 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 really loud. And I actually instructed my follow spot operators to take their headsets off and just like the show. Nobody noticed. It was so good. We had a good crew here. But Hendrix was here, Janis Joplin. We did everybody here.
I want to take a quick break maybe and play a song from a CD. And you know, when we met, we spoke a lot. We turned out we have some mutual acquaintances and friends.
Bob Westcott.
I was very blown away that the great song written by Bob Westcott, Mr. Moisey's Gumbo, is about you and about your gumbo. And that just blew me away because this is a song that I've known for a long time, and I've known Bob for a long time, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners out there that are active in the Long Island music scene and are fans of the Long Island music scene know the name Bob Westcott because he's done so much stuff here on Long Island as far as at the Folk Music Society and his concerts he puts on every Christmas time, the holiday concert he does over there. And he's a great performer too, as well. Great songwriter and all around nice guy.
And that guy can rock.
And he wrote a great song, Mr. Moisey's Gumbo. And well, I was just a little blown away that song's about you. So it's a short song, and we'll take a little break now and hear it right now. Bob Westcott and Mr. Moisey's Gumbo. And then, of course, when we get back, I'll have to ask you about the gumbo. Yeah, Mr. Moisey's Gumbo. Actually, the liner notes say, with apologies to Mrs. Moisey, who does most of the work.
Well, you're just being kind to her because she's actually here.
Hey.
Actually, the truth of the matter was I had the great pleasure of doing, later on in my career, I did a series of shows for HBO Cinemax down in New Orleans and spent about 4 weeks down there eating the gumbo. And you just love the music and you just love the food down there. So I came back home here and I can't cook. Then I couldn't cook anything. And I tried to cook a gumbo by color, you know, mixing ingredients until it looked like the right color. And Jeanette thankfully rescued me from that. We got a recipe from Paul Prudhomme and we started making what Bob Westcott calls the best seafood gumbo north of New Orleans, and we got it down. We get a black roux out of it, and the big problem is I can't go to any Bob Westcott gigs anymore because he plays the song. Everybody comes up and says, can I have some gumbo? Yeah, but it's a great gumbo.
It's a great song, too. That's a nice little tune, and it's a song that just hit me when that CD came out. That's the, you know, a couple of tunes, reached out at me, but that was one of them. So I was, like I said, I was very shocked when I put two and two together there.
Well, I detected a few strains there, like a bottle of wine, fruit of the vine, which Bob knows me real well. We share our New Year's every year. A little Toby Walker there too.
Yeah. Now I would be remiss to not mention the Capitol Theater and your involvement with the Capitol Theater in Passaic, New Jersey. That's a big part of your website and what you've done. And now you also not only did the lighting, but you're also an illustrator and an artist.
Well, I like so many people in the world, I planned my life without any plan at all. It just sort of came at me. And in 1971, I was already here a little bit over. I was on the faculty, actually, working at the Instructional Resources Center. And they kind of, I guess, sleezed an extra year doing the lights here. And what happened in the transition was the Grateful Dead were hiring a lighting director, and they hired Candace Brightman, who's to this day my favorite lighting director. And she was working for Howard Stein in New York and John Shear in New Jersey, or she had just agreed to work for John. And so she needed a replacement real fast. And Stony Brook was one of the three top East Coast places to play in those days, the other ones being in New York, the Fillmore and the Academy, and also Howard Stein's Capitol. So when she left New York, that left a vacancy at the Academy of Music in 14th Street, and also the Capitol in Passaic, which was the most important concert hall under 6,000 seats, according to Rolling Stone, in all time. So due to a guy named George Geranius, who helped set up this radio station and was one of the early people at Stony Brook, he put Candace in touch with me, and she knew me from my reputation here. And I went directly from here to the Capitol Theater on its opening night, December 16th, 1971. And I did every show, did the lights there for every show through its closing around 1986 or 1988. There might have been a few I missed. But the other part you mentioned was the artwork, and it was a real pleasure to be on the East Coast then rather than the West Coast, because the West Coast, they would do a program, they'd hire a great artist and they'd do one cover, and they use the cover for all the programs for the whole year. And what John Shear did was he took a different approach. He didn't have this psychedelic art. He had Moissey, and he hired me to do a different cover for every program, and we did hundreds of shows there. And then, of course, we did the shows at all of his venues. So altogether, there's about 300 of them. There's a few million people that have seen these things. So I had a ball. Every one of those covers plays to the band, some subtle thing about their titles or music or something like that. And if you go to my website, moissi.com, M-O-Y-S-S-I.com, you might have some fun trying to figure out why the hell I drew that cover for that band. We did one for the Rolling Stones where I got 25 of their album covers in one illustration.
Very cool. Actually, I told you before the show, I have a few of those. I have a few of your handbills from concerts I went to. And you also did ones at the Long Island Arena a little bit.
That's
and
right,
some other venues there, like the Felt Forum and Madison Square Garden.
All of
Jean Cher shows, basically, right?
Well, actually, the ones you mentioned at the Island Arena were for Alan Shapiro, who was the SAB's bean counter when I was their lighting director. He went out and became a promoter on his own, and he actually started the ball rolling, came over to my house one day, and said, I'm doing a bunch of shows here. He did the Island Arena and White Plains Music Hall, and also talked John Scheer into allowing him to do some programs there. That's how that whole thing got started. I did 21 covers for programs, which I never got paid for. It was an early lesson in rock and roll. It was, yes, take the cash.
Definitely. Well, the half hour went really fast. It's been great having you here. And perhaps we'll get you back sometime to talk a little bit more. I know a lot of people are very interested in your stories and what you have to say.
Well, thank you. I really appreciated this.
Well, I appreciate having you here. We have another guest tonight. We have John Backoff, and you heard him playing before. He's a great musician from right here in Long Island. Perhaps we'll go out with one tune from a CD you brought while we set John up.
See, I don't know.
Maybe we'll hear from...
Well, the 71 set is the one that's out there on the...
Okay. Maybe we'll just hear a tune from this, since we can tell people what song it is.
Well, I'll tell you... Potluck,
right?
Oh, Potluck. You might get Potluck. A 45-minute tune there.
Well, we'll just have to fade it out, if that happens.
Because that 1970
This is the Allman Brothers, 1970, in July of 1970, right here at Stony Brook, at the gym. Right?
July 10th, not July 26th.
July 10th. That's one thing as a public service announcement to all the Allman Brothers fans out there. The tapes you have labeled as July 26th are actually July 10th. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, Moisey, thanks so much for coming up tonight. And like I said, we'll do this again sometime.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. And again, this is the Allman Brothers from July 1970 here at Stony Brook. And I'll probably have to fade it out because they're known to do those very long songs. And we don't have 45 minutes, but we have John Backoff that's about to come in and play live for you a little bit. So stay tuned. This is WUSB Stony Brook and the Long Island Sound.